ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, I'm Michael Rowland, and this is the Radio National Hour, coming to you from the land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Coming up, it was billed as one of the most consequential diplomatic showdowns in years. Presidents Trump and Xi emerged triumphant from their bilateral meeting in South Korea yesterday. Their differences over trade were settled for now. But has China exposed a chink in America's armour? And if so, what does that mean for us? Also ahead, world-famous chef Yotam Ottolenghi is coming for dinner. What do you cook? It sounds like the beginnings of a nightmare, doesn't it? But even the master himself has been known to get a little stressed in front of an audience.
And a fellow chef from the UK that was a little bit more experienced, Mark Swearing, said to me, you know, like, before you go on stage, just get a shot of something, a vodka or whiskey or something, just to calm your nerves, because you look very, very stressed. And I did.
Yotam Ottolenghi joins me later this hour to talk about his mission to make people feel more comfortable in the kitchen with his new live show. The vodka and whiskey are optional. 12 out of 10, that's how Donald Trump scored his long-awaited meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping in Busan yesterday. Both leaders emerged claiming success. China securing a partial reprieve on US tariffs and, in return, agreeing to wind back those export controls on rare earths. But behind the optics, did the fundamentals change? The world's two largest economies are still locked in a slow-burning rivalry on trade, technology, and, of course, ideology. So, was the meeting a breakthrough or just a brief step back from the brink? To take a deeper look at the meeting, with me now is former Foreign Minister and New South Wales Premier Bob Carr, former American diplomat Sarah Berran, who served as US Chargé d'Affaires in Beijing, and Andrew K.P. Leung, an independent China strategist based in Hong Kong. Bob, Sarah and Andrew, welcome to the Radio National Hour.
Pleasure to be
Thank
here.
You. Good to be here.
Bob, I want to start with you. This was a meeting of two leaders with profoundly, profoundly different worldviews, leadership styles and also negotiating tactics. What, in your view, was the best possible outcome for both sides, and was it achieved?
Well, the best outcome for both sides was to keep talking. And they've done that. But more than that, they've settled, in a way I think they'll have to continue to settle, these four or five areas of disagreement. What is very significant is the confirmation that they'll be visiting one another in 2026. And that creates strong pressure in the bureaucracies of both sides to make those summits a success. And then very quickly, I'll throw this in, the world seems to have passed over the fact that China and the US were meeting on a basis of equality. Indeed, if anything, the Chinese counterpunch to Trump's flamboyant moves on tariffs, namely to hit back with soybeans and with rare earths, worked very well for them. The Chinese counterpunch worked. Both sides came together as, I might say, peer powers. America used to refer, Kurt Campbell was fond of referring to China as a near peer power. That was quite astute and quite realist. But I think the impression Asia will have at this moment is that they were meeting as equals.
Sarah, do you agree with that assessment? Did they meet as peer powers, as Bob just said? And also, broadly speaking, from a US foreign policy perspective, was this meeting a success for America?
I agree that something has shifted in the last year. In the past, China would not have hit back asymmetrically and aggressively with rare earth export controls, upping the ante. In the past, their approach was one of proportional retaliation, mirror the US actions, but always hit just a little bit less. Something shifted this time. So we're dealing now with a China that is much more confident and perhaps overconfident of its leverage. I do think this is a tactical truce, and I expect that we'll see tensions begin to reemerge pretty soon and probably additional escalation in the period before the two leaders meet again in April. And the reason for that is I think there are probably very different understandings about the agreements reached. We don't have a statement yet from the US side that indicates the precise nature of the agreements. In the Chinese statement, it appears that many details are still to be worked out.
That's a very good point. Andrew, over to you. Donald Trump was positively effervescent coming out of the meeting. President Xi, a bit less effusive about it. And as Sarah says, we're yet to see the nuts and bolts of what was agreed to. Andrew, in your view, was this summit in South Korea a success from China's perspective?
And don't forget that when President Trump won the White House in the first time, President Xi already knew what was coming, and he directed the nation to double down on self-reliance on technology and also trying to reject the economy towards more internal consumption, less reliance on export. So he knew what was coming, and that was starting from Trump 1.0. So now the China's economy is as far as the exports are concerned, even though the United States is the largest economy in the world, but then the exposure of China's export to the United States has dramatically decreased. Overall, China's export to the United States only accounts for something like 10% or even less than 10% of China's total export, because the rest of the export has been redirected and pivoted towards the global south. According to the IMF latest figures, accounts for 58% of the global GDP. So as a result, even though China's export to the United States has dwindled because of the tariffs, in fact, its overall export to the entire world, including the United States, has actually increased during the past months because of this pivoted towards the global south. Yeah. So I think that China became more confident, not all of a sudden, but because of tracing back to Trump 1.0, is well prepared for this. And now you can see that China is beginning to dictate the tempo of the negotiations.
I want to just jump in there. That's excuse the interruption. They certainly learned from Trump 1.0. I want to talk a bit more about trade in some detail coming up. But Bob, back to you on Sarah's point about China being overconfident. Do you detect that? Is there a bit of hubris in China's global positioning at the moment, not just vis-a-vis its relationship with the United States, but the world more generally?
I see a broader trend in China to move beyond what we baptized wolf warrior diplomacy. It has caused them problems in their relationships with European nations. And I think there's a strong prospect, rather than being overconfident, of China having learnt from the mistakes of the last five or so years and closing what I would call the diplomatic deficit, that China's diplomacy has not matched with agility or subtlety the rise in China's economic and military power. If they've learned a lesson from the last five or more years, it's that they've got to use charm and give the appearance, at least, of restraint. I think they'd be pretty happy of where their diplomacy more recently has got them. But, of course, in their relationship with the world's prevailing power, the United States, they would have to be congratulating themselves behind closed doors that their counterpunch with soybeans and rare earths has worked decisively for them. And they've got Donald Trump, the US president, maybe entrenched in seeing that his role is to deliver peace, not just peace in Gaza, but in Ukraine and ultimately in US relations with China.
Former Australian Foreign Minister Bob Carr, former American diplomat Sarah Barron, and China strategist Andrew Leung are with me on the Radio National Hour. We're talking, of course, about yesterday's meeting between Presidents Trump and Xi in Busan, South Korea. Sarah, talking more in detail about trade now, the disputes were really kicked off by Donald Trump's so-called Liberation Day tariffs back in April. We've discussed this a bit already about the rare earths export controls. In your view, based on your deep understanding of how China works, was it predictable that China would respond to Trump's tariffs by essentially weaponizing its control, its dominance over rare earths?
Yes, I think this was a predictable reaction. We saw this start last year, December 2024. There were export control measures rolled out against rare earths. I think that was a warning signal to the incoming Trump administration that China was prepared to weaponize. The April measures that were rolled out hit a number of different rare earths and magnets. I will note this truce only seems to roll back the October rare earth export controls, which were much more extensive and concerning. But the controls from April still remain in place. And we are continuing to see delays and have been through the summer in provision of rare earths and magnets to companies, not just in the United States, but globally. And this is trickling through supply chains and could continue to have impact even after this truce. In addition to the rare earths piece, you know, soybeans, the pledges that the Chinese made for purchases this year and next only bring us back to where we were in 2024. This is not a massive new purchase agreement.
Andrew, China and America have very different views on trade. The US sees it very much, it could be argued, as a winner-takes-all situation. But China sees trade relations very differently, doesn't it?
Yes, of course, on different in different aspects. First of all, on rare earths is China's newfound countermeasure. Of course, the rare earths have been with us for a long, long time. It's only recently, maybe just the past couple of less than a year, and China discovered that this would be a very effective countermeasure against the United States coercion. Recently, China doubled down on the controlling not only the export of rare earths, but also the machinery used to produce these rare earths, and also the intellectual property refining these rare earths, because they are very, very complicated, very, very polluting, highly polluting, and in the beginning, no country wanted them, and they were lumped onto China decades ago, and China has now developed the expertise, the technology, the whole ecosystem, refining these rare earths, and suddenly China found it would be very effective stranglehold on Americans' Achilles heel. The extension of the control is not to target the rest of the world, but to prevent Americans' allies reshipping this rare earth to the United States. It's basically a countermeasure against the United States coercion, not so much that China want to make an enemy for other countries which also need these rare earths. Now, coming back to the start of negotiation, that's very, very important to understand China's philosophy. The Chinese spokesman recently highlighted the fact that China would be willing to meet American halfway. Now, halfway means the in Chinese philosophy means the golden mean, and that's been with the Chinese civilization long, long time ago. But the style of negotiation in the United States is very different, especially with the Trump administration. It's also always American first. American can win. It's either black or white, and winner takes all kind of mentality, and if not taking all, at least the lion's share. And so that's a very fundamental difference.
Sarah and Bob, I want to go to you on rare earths again. Sarah first, China does have this dominance over rare earths. It's agreed to wind back export controls, I believe, only for a year or so. America is so vulnerable here, isn't it? It is years behind China, and even if it presses start on refining projects and rare earth mining now, it'll take years and years to catch up. So China is aware it holds the whip hand here. I want to get your views and get Bob's as well after yours.
Absolutely. And I think you've hit the nail on the head here. It's going to take at least a decade to relocate these supply chains and diversify away from reliance on China. It's not just about the mining. It's refining, processing, the whole supply chain. And in particular, that refining and processing piece, as our colleagues on the call noted, is an area where China has monopolized the know-how, the expertise, and the machinery. So it's going to take a concerted effort. And this is not something, in my view, that the United States can act alone on. I was heartened to see that there are rare earth components in some of the trade agreements reached by Trump during this tour through Asia. Glad to see when Australian Prime Minister traveled to Washington earlier this month, that was also part of the discussion. It's going to take a concerted effort by countries around the world to work together to diversify away from reliance on China, put price floors in place, direct investment towards these multi-year projects, and try to create some horizon for companies to invest the time, the energy, and the money in developing these supply chains, because this is a market failure here. The reason why, one of the reasons why China was able to monopolize this space is the scale, the cost, and the subsidies that the government brought to bear. So unless other countries put similar efforts towards clawing back those supply chains, we're just not going to see it happen. And again, I want to underscore here, the export controls that were delayed a year were only the October export controls. Mm-hmm. So we're still facing two other sets in place that are going to delay and disrupt supply chains going forward.
And Bob, America has a lot of ground to catch up here, don't they? And Australia, that deal with Australia on rare earths, is only a small part of the broader challenge facing America.
Yeah, the big challenge is to get processing up and the development approval path. I speak as a former planning minister in New South Wales. The development approval path is going to be very rugged in any developed country. The crunch we faced is not the supply of the raw materials, but catching up with processing. And if you think about it more broadly, doesn't this represent another factor that pushes both sides towards, even if it's uneasy, even if it's short-lived, even if it's vulnerable, towards more understanding and more collaboration? Isn't not only Trump, but any president in the future thinking of the Trump experience with soybeans and rare earths, going to say there is something to be achieved in collaboration rather than confrontation with China? All of this has got to be speculative, but you can see elements, if not of a G2 understanding to run the world, but of what Marco Rubio seemed to be talking about at the very start, great power to great power relationships, built, as has been confirmed in the last couple of days, on America treating China as a peer power, with an expectation in Asia that this is the world of the future, that American primacy in Asia has well and truly finished, which even Australia concedes. And we're dealing, as Singaporean leaders, former prime minister, former foreign minister have said quite explicitly, we're dealing with a powerful China, the predominant power in the region, but it's not terrifying for Southeast Asians because we've been used to it in the past, in the era of dynastic China and the clout it was able to wield in Southeast Asia.
And speaking of which, I want to close out our conversation shortly with a look at the strategic outlook in our region. But before then, Andrew, one of Donald Trump's priorities for those discussions with Xi was tighter restrictions on the chemicals China exports that go into making the drug fentanyl, which, as we all know, is a big issue in America. Andrew, is this of any consequence to China, this concession, or was it more of a good faith bargaining move by Xi?
Well, of course, China's targeting the Trump's main concerns in the immediate future with the coming midterm elections. And that's why China's willing to concede on the soybeans as well as suspending the implementation on the restrictions on rare earths. But I think that at the end of the day, if China wants to regain its rightful place in the sun as at least a peer power compared with the United States, there are two stumbling blocks which Beijing is well aware of. And the first one is of course, China's now tuned down so-called wolf warrior kind of rhetoric. And you can see that one of the spokesmen, spokesperson on the wolf warrior kind of rhetoric has recently been demoted or fired. And I think you can say this, you can see the scaling down of this kind of narrative. The second stumbling block, I think that Beijing is trying to address is because China's exports are so competitive, not just on price, but on quality and on innovation. This is a good thing for China, but it's not necessarily a good thing for a lot of the industries. For example, the vehicle, the electric vehicle industry, which are pillars of the economies in Europe and in other countries. So if China keeps on exporting this highly competitive products, it's going to destroy jobs and also creating a kind of friction. So I think that the recent development is that China is now wising up to it, trying to outsource some of the production of the electric vehicle. Now I think that countries, even Australia, could benefit from this, you know, sort of Chinese investments there. Of course, you've got to be aware of security concerns, but that sometimes can be overblown. So I think that this is the second hurdle for China to regain its place in the sun is outsourcing some of the productions around the world and creating jobs and benefiting the host countries.
Richard's doing it in a clearly very methodical way. You're listening to the Radio National Hour. My guests are Bob Carr, Sarah Barron and Andrew KP Leung. We're taking a look at the outcome of that Xi Trump summit yesterday. I want to, as I mentioned, close out the conversation with a look at the region. Sarah, okay, we have this temporary truce mainly on trade. In your view, will it result in any de-escalation of the tensions we're seeing in the Asia Pacific and the South China Sea? China clearly has very strong ambitions in that area. What's your perspective there?
Michael, it's a good question. I think stabilization of the U.S.-China relationship is not just good for the U.S. and China, it is good for the region. So leader-level touch points are one way to help stabilize different pieces here. The issue I see here, though, is the meeting does not appear to have dealt with some of those deeper structural strategic issues. Trump is claiming that Taiwan was not raised in the course of the meeting. I will tell you, having sat through five meetings between U.S. leaders and Xi Jinping over the course of the last couple of years, there is no doubt in my mind that the Chinese side raised Taiwan. The question is, what was the context and what was the U.S. response? I think how the U.S. would have responded to that intervention is important. China, I think, needs to see that the U.S. continues to have a stake in peace and stability across the Taiwan Strait. I think if there's an impression that that commitment is waning, it will cause additional adventurism on the Chinese side. Similarly, on South China Sea, it is often the case that China tests and sees and looks for a response. If there is no response, it continues to salami slice away at the status quo. So that is my concern in not dealing with some of the deeper strategic issues. The U.S. is essentially giving China free rein to continue to test and probe and expand presence.
Interesting perspective there, Bob, from Sarah, on Taiwan possibly being raised in those talks. Let's talk about Taiwan. Donald Trump, in his meeting with our Prime Minister Anthony Albanese in Washington, recently said he was of the view that China didn't want to invade Taiwan. Should he be so relaxed about that? And how do you see this playing out as clearly a very tense U.S.-China relationship continues to hover over our region, particularly when it comes to places like Taiwan?
Yeah, I think you've got to say that of all American presidents, this one is less rhetorically committed to Taiwan. I can't think of any other U.S. president who's been as publicly critical of Taiwan as President Trump has been. The mystery is the Chinese attitude to Taiwan in the context of the messages that Trump seems to be sending. But overall, I think those of us in the region, those of us who want to avoid an entirely unnecessary clash between the US and China, have got to be relieved at where we now stand. There is no more provocation like the Pelosi visit 5 years ago to Taipei. I think the Taiwanese leadership is astute enough to know that any repetition of that would be damaging all round. And indeed, when Speaker McCarthy met the president of Taiwan, he didn't replicate the Pelosi visit. They met on American soil, and there must have been a lot of consideration behind that gesture. China will maintain the rhetorical insistence on the status of Taiwan. That's at the very core of Chinese diplomacy. But I think Trump, from hints in his speeches and commentary interviews, has take seriously an assurance he seems to have received from Xi that China will not mount an attempt at reunification by force, that China would not take military action in the Taiwan Strait. Now, that points to a broader regional interest in this. American partners like Australia, Japan, and South Korea have a strong stake in the avoidance of conflict and would cheer every bit of evidence that a US-China accommodation is being reached or is close to being reached. That's our interest in it. I'd go so far as to say a détente between China and the US is something that Australia, South Korea, that the ASEAN states, with the exception of Taiwan, with the exception of Philippines, would cheer the notion that the rising power and the prevailing power, or two peer powers, as they've now been described after this summit especially, can accommodate their differences.
We are literally...
Michael, can I jump in with one quick point?
Yes.
I just want to focus in on this question of the use of force. I will note the day before the meeting, the Chinese state media came out and clearly noted that China had not renounced the use of force across the Taiwan Strait. So I want to be clear, that is not a commitment China has made and continues to say the opposite in public. Now, what they have said is use of force is not their first choice. Their preference is for peaceful reunification. But I don't think any of us should have blinders on that the goal is reunification by any means necessary. And the importance of the United States continuing to express an interest in peace and stability and continuing to work with partners and allies in the region is to provide a counterbalance, as Bob says, against a more aggressive China. If the United States starts to pull back and no longer provides that counterbalance or that interest, I think we will see more aggression from China across the strait. Not an invasion, that is not what I'm saying, but more aggression in a way that will destabilize the region.
Interesting times.
Coming on this very important point.
Yes.
Please. I think that there's a huge misunderstanding of Beijing's stand on Taiwan. Of course, as my colleague has said, Beijing has never given up the use of force. And then President Xi years ago that the aim of the Chinese Renaissance is the reunification at the latest 2049, which is the 100th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China. But then the preference is for peaceful unification, as highlighted earlier, enshrined in three white papers issued by Beijing. The last coincided with Nancy Pelosi's provocative visit to Taiwan. Now, how peaceful unification is going to be achieved, but silently, and the momentum is towards that goal. There are a number of dynamics. First of all, Taiwan is diplomatically isolated. And secondly, China is doubling down on deterrence measures, military deterrence measures, to counter any kind of pro-independence movements or sentiments. And thirdly, and more importantly, the two economies are increasingly intertwined, and a lot of Taiwanese people, in fact, even now, as many as 300,000 Taiwanese people, families, together with their families, are living and working on the mainland on their businesses. So the two peoples are increasingly interacting with one another. Of course, the two systems are not the same, but that's not the end of the world. So I think that there's through a combination of military deterrence, diplomatic isolation, somehow, you know, creating a momentum, moving the Taiwanese government towards a negotiation. So I think that that's the aim. 2027 was in fact mentioned by President Xi. And that's the time when China should prepare itself militarily against any separatist movements or open declaration of independence in Taiwan. But that doesn't mean that China is going to invade Taiwan by 2027, because the waters over Taiwan is a treacherous trap. Beijing is seeing this rhetoric as a trap to trap Beijing into an unwinnable war over the Taiwan Strait. So the preference is still on peaceful unification through the means of our line.
I guess we'll find out in a little over 12 months' time. Interesting times ahead. Sarah, Andrew, Bob, thank you all for joining me on the Radio National Hour.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bob Carr is a former foreign minister and Premier of New South Wales. Sarah Barron is a former American diplomat who served as United States Chargé d'Affaires to the People's Republic of China in Beijing. And Andrew Leung is an independent China strategist in Hong Kong.
I'm nervous. Are you?
Just 4 hours to paint your favourite celebrity.
I'm so scared right now, it doesn't matter.
You've got this.
Like Mark Cole Smith, Amanda Keller and Reese Nicholson.
Painting is like a battle.
Bang. Your time is up.
Artists, turn your easels.
That's me.
Who will be crowned winner of Portrait Artist of the Year?
Wow. You're clever people.
Start Sunday, November 2 on ABC TV or stream all the episodes on ABC iView.
This is Michael Rowland, sitting in for Fran Kelly on the Radio National Hour.
What's your go-to meal when you're feeling like eating something comforting? For me, it's a bowl of pasta with some garlic and olive oil and a dash of chilli. It's so simple, yet it hits the spot each and every time. Beloved chef, restaurateur and food writer Yotam Ottolenghi has thought a lot about the food we find comforting in his current cookbook, called appropriately Comfort. Now he's coming to Australia on a national tour, and he's looking to help us all feel a little bit more comfortable in the kitchen, not just in what we make, but how we make it. Yotam, welcome to the Radio National Hour.
Thank you very much. It's great to be there.
Yotam, you describe yourself as growing up in an incredible mumble jumble of food. Your father's family were from Italy, your mother's Berlin Jewish family. What are some of the first tastes and flavours you remember emanating from the kitchen at home when you were a child?
Oh, good question. So I had, as you said, my father was from an Italian family, and we used to have quite expectedly quite a lot of pasta. So my father would make this delicious ragu, and it was an unusual one because it didn't have a lot of, it was not unusual. It was just the way they do it. Actually, people do in Italy quite a lot. It didn't have a lot of tomatoes. They had more. It was paler. Maybe there were a couple of tomatoes, but it was paler. It had lots of herbs and hard herbs like rosemary or thyme. It was slow cooked and it was absolutely delicious. It really tasted of beef. And actually, in Comfort, Helen Go and I have this kind of a spread with two types of bolognese. One is a ragù bianco, which is a kind of an homage to my father's ragù. And there's one that we call it Helen's bolognese. And actually, it's not really a bolognese. It's got a lot of Chinese flavors in it as well. But we just thought that we're going to be cheeky and call it a bolognese. But there was some pushback from people. So that is just not a bolognese. But for us, it doesn't matter if it's a beef ragu or a meaty ragu, and it's got those, and you use it for pasta, we call it bolognese.
And it just sounds delicious, as I'm sure it tastes delicious. Was there a moment when you learned to cook something that gave you the spark, that sparked clearly this lifelong interest in food, in cooking?
I cooked a little as a kid, so I did I was playing with basic things like I've got young kids, so like they make eggs in the morning, they help with cakes. They're not really into the day to day cooking, and I was kind of that kind of kid myself. But when I went to university, I had to fend for myself, as a lot of people find out when they leave home, and this was when I properly fell in love with cooking. And I lived in very next to the market in Tel Aviv, and I fell in love with all the ingredients there, the summer vegetables like the courgettes, tomatoes, mm-hmm. eggplants. And I remember making this something which I would now maybe describe as a ratatouille, but there's no name to it, but lots of like taking lots of delicious vegetables and roasting them and turning them into a sauce just by putting them in the oven. And this still works for me to this day, like roasting summer vegetable really, really well and turning them into a sauce that can go over rice or over pasta. These were kind of my first experiences of cooking. Also cheese, like there was a stall that sold feta style cheese, so kind of young white cheeses of various types, saltier and milder. And I remember just like tasting them and thinking, wow, what an incredible world out there of food just by tasting all these varieties of cheese.
And happy to say you're still out there tasting and making some wonderful food as well. Yoltam, you mentioned your children there. They're a little older now, able to, I guess, discern what they do and don't like to do and help in the kitchen. Was having kids change the way you approach or think about food?
Yes, it has. And when I think about it, I know to break down food into its different components through the kids, because kids are funny like that. They go, they're actually very honest. You know, they say what's on their mind. They don't spare you. So, you know, if they don't like it, they don't like it. So I kind of, for instance, one of the things that I realized through kids is to distinguish between in a dish between the flavors and the texture. So as a grown-up, normally you kind of just amalgamate everything when you eat. You know, you have a flavor and texture. They all end up together. But kids really kind of shout out. So my youngest son, especially, he really loves certain textures, but he doesn't like certain flavors. So I almost have like to deconstruct food. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, to serve, he's not like that anymore, but he used to ask me to serve the pasta first and then the sauce.
Right.
And I kind of understand it, because there's this pure palate, you know, that I just want to get the flint. And I'm a little bit like that. Obviously, I like the pasta with the sauce. But I think there is a kind of understanding of how food operates and how we perceive it that does come through the interaction with kids.
You once said, Yoltam, that being in the kitchen cooking is when you're at your most relaxed. I wonder whether that is still the case, given it's now obviously your work too.
Well, I have said that and I stand behind it. If I make something that I've made many times and is familiar and I don't need to think too much, it is the most relaxing thing in the world. I kind of go on autopilot. You know, if I make a big pot of something like a stew, a curry, a ragu or something for the kids, I find the chopping of the vegetable, the stirring, the waiting, I find that very meditative, very relaxing. When it comes to, like, if I cook for a dinner party for friends that are coming over, I find that less relaxing, because I think, like everyone else, I want it to be the best version possible. And I know there is a time limit, and I know things need to be at a certain temperature at a particular point. So for those kind of events, I've kind of developed some techniques of kind of just preparing ahead of time, not having everything warm, etc. So I don't stress out. And talking about the show that I'm going to do, so I will talk about some of these considerations. How can you make your cooking more relaxing by knowing some basic technique and then elevating them and adding more elements to make it feel really, really special, but without the stress, without feeling like you have to learn something completely new every time you cook for your friends or your family.
And speaking of the show, you often do those talks and cook in front of thousands of people. Do you find that relaxing, or is that a bit stressful?
I used to find it very, very stressful. I'll tell you a story. The first time I came, the first big event that I have ever done in front of an audience was in Melbourne many years ago. And I was in a casino, and I had, it was in Sydney, and I had to, Melbourne, and I had to cook, and I had to cook in front of, I don't know, what seemed like a massive crowd. I think it was 500 people. Now I've got more. And I was very, very stressed. I couldn't sleep the whole night. I was fidgeting. I was really very, very, very stressed. And a fellow chef from the UK that was a little bit more experienced, Mark Swearing, said to me, you know, like, before you go on stage, just get a shot of something, a vodka or whiskey or something, just to calm your nerves, because you look very, very stressed. And I did. And I survived it. It was fine. And ever since, it's getting less and less stressful. But I still have these kind of moments when I go like, oh gosh, there's so many people. I hope I get it right.
Oh, that is so humbling as well. Do you still take this shot to settle the nerves sometime? We don't need that anymore.
No, I haven't had one since then. I've managed to calm my nerves. I think for me, it's much more about the unknown. So, I mean, that's just what nervousness is about. And I don't feel that, I know I've done it many times now. I go on stage and I think like, what's the worst that could happen? And I think of previous experiences, and it kind of calms me and says, okay, well, you can do it.
And you do it so well. Chef, restaurateur and food writer Yotam Ottolenghi is with me on the Radio National Hour. As he's mentioned, he's heading our way for a national tour in February next year. Yotam, your latest cookbook, Comfort, was released last year. It digs into the food that essentially feels like a hug. Was putting the recipes together hard, given comfort can mean different things to different people? How did you end up defining comfort food?
There were many conversations, and it was also a kind of a joint project between the four of us. So Helen Goh, who I'm sure many of your listeners know, she's an Aussie. She's been working with me for many years. She's just got her own book out, which is amazing, a baking book. And Verena Lochmuller and Tara Wigley, we all collaborated on this book, and each person kind of added some of their perspective. With Helen in particular, it was really, we've had some really interesting conversations because of her Chinese-Malaysian background. Much of this book has those particular elements. And what we realized when we were working on the book is that, yeah, comfort is very culture specific. So, you know, each culture has its own set of comfort dishes, what you eat when you want to, you know, when you want ease, when you want a bit of soul, you know, a soulful moment. But there's also a lot of things that cultures have in common, which we really emphasize in the book. And one of them is, there's a few of them, but if I can mention a couple, one of them is pasta and noodles. And I think that kind of, that's really cross-cultural. That's something that you can find in many cultures, from China to India to Greece to Italy, obviously. You find different types of noodles, and they do different things on the plate, but it's the textural thing. I was talking earlier about my son and wanting the pasta without the sauce. I think what he wants is pure texture. Mm-hmm. And for me, pasta and noodles are pure texture. The sauce matters, but it's the actual experience with the noodles or the pasta, that textural aspect that really makes it special. This is why Italians are so obsessed with getting the pasta al dente, not overcooking it, because you kind of lose everything if you overcook it.
The way we eat is also identified as one of the aspects of comfort in food. What do the implements we use have to do with the way we feel about a meal?
I think two elements that I can easily identify is a bowl. So eating from a bowl and eating with your hands. So you think about a slice of pizza. If you pick it up with your hand and bring it close to your mouth and like get up and close with it, is for me very comforting. I think it's one of the attractions of a pizza. I think if you eat it with a knife or fork, and I've seen some people commit this cardinal sin and do it, it's almost like you're getting it wrong. You know, you're getting all the opportunity that you get with a pizza is just by holding it. I think the same applies to a bowl of soup or of noodles. Again, it's like getting it up and close to your face and really enjoying all the aspects of the food, you know, the smell and the warmth. And so, yeah, so I think getting up and close with your food is definitely a way of making it comfortable. The more formal the dining experience, the less comforting it is.
I'm with you on people who eat pizza with a knife and fork. Horrible.
It's just wrong. It's just wrong. I always shame them on stage, and I say, who eats a pizza with a knife and fork? And a few sheepish hands come up, and I think, like, I feel for them because they have to admit that they do it, and maybe they learn.
Maybe they learn from the great Yotam on stage. The introduction of the book points out the link between comfort food and travel and immigration, the importance of bringing favourite flavours and a taste of home with you no matter where you go or emigrate to. Is this underrated? Do you think in a world where we have access to so many more ingredients than ever before, that this link between travel, immigration and food?
I don't think it's underrated. I think it's very much celebrated by the fact that, you know, yes, we are exposed to a lot of foods all around us all the time, which is wonderful. But I think people really understand different cuisines better. I mean, I'm not the one to kind of say, oh, social media is a way to learn about cooking. I think actually quite the opposite. If you want to learn about cooking properly, you just need to cook, not watch it. But there is something about informing people and getting exposed into different kind of cuisines. And that's got a lot to do with the origins of the dishes that are, you know, presented, whether it's in book or on screen. So, you know, people, I think the loudest voices, well, I'm one of them, Helen's another one, Verena's one of them. We are immigrants, and I think we have a very strong sense of who we were and where we are, where we left and where we landed. And I think that makes the food very rich, very interesting. And in the book, we celebrate that because almost every dish in this book is kind of emanates from our personal experiences. You know, there is a wonderful marble cake in the book that's Verena, the other co-author in the book. It's called Back to Childhood Marble Cake. It's just a wonderful, really beautiful crumb, soft, something you want to have in the afternoon with a cup of coffee. And that's a kind of a homage to a celebration that happens every weekend in a German household, or every week that people sit in the afternoon and have a cup of coffee and a cake and a sponge cake. So, you know, it was important for her to be there, Helen with her bolognese. So there is this something that immigration, just that richness that it brings. And I think people do realize how important it is because it does inform what we cook these days very much.
You're listening to the Radio National Hour with me, Michael Rowland. My guest is world-famous chef Yotam Ottolenghi. Yotam, you encourage experimentation in cooking, but for some it can be hard to feel adventurous when you're tired, you get home from work after a long day. How do you recommend people stay creative in the kitchen when they've got so much in the way of other demands on their time?
Now you've asked me the question that I love answering because I think it's very easy to be defeatist about cooking and just say, well, like, all these barriers, I'm just going to order takeaway, or, you know, and which is something that I do too. But in the show that I'm going to be presenting all these ways to kind of take down those barriers to cooking. So we have this world now where you can do something not from scratch every time you walk into the kitchen. For that, you can reheat something that you've made the previous night. You know, if you have a really good rice, then you can turn it quickly into a fried rice. Quick meal with things that you already have there, bits of sausage and an egg and some vegetables that are, you know, sitting there in your fridge. Or we can use all these wonderful condiments that we can buy now, you know, a jar of harissa or pesto, and then you cook something, but you have all these assists. I mean, I've introduced a line of those condiments, harissa and pesto and sauces and marinades, and they've been flying. I mean, not because people don't want to cook, but because they want to cook more, and they are those kind of lifesavers that we have. So rather than, you know, buy a ready meal or eat something that's not the best for you, get one of these jars of condiment or make one at home and keep it in your fridge and have it ready for the right moment. And I will speak a lot in the show about kind of all these wonderful flavors that you can introduce into your cooking, but without effort, because I just don't like the idea that people feel guilty for not cooking. I don't think if you don't want to cook, it's absolutely fine. But I also think there is ways in that are much simpler, easier and comforting, using that word again, than people might think.
Do you have a flavor or an ingredient that you're experimenting with or obsessed with at the moment?
always something. There's always something. We are working on more item to go into the range of products that I've been developing and selling. And they're also available in Australia. And we're working on this. We have been working on this preserved lemon marinade that's really, really nice. So it's got a bit of sweetness, a bit of sour, and it's a wonderful thing to marinate. Yeah, whatever you feel like using chicken. It's even nice, like diluted over fish. So I just love I love preserved lemons, as you've probably know if you've read my book, but to turn it into a paste that's a marinade that's applicable to food, it's another wonderful shortcut, and I've been using it a lot to marinate chicken.
What do you think of my comfort food? I mentioned at the top, pasta alle olio, olive oil, garlic and chilli. It's very boring compared to the stuff you make and suggest, but I tell you what, it's. I'm often tired, I get home, I cook that, it takes 5 or 10 minutes to get the pasta al dente, and it just works all the time.
It's just, you know what, I think this is also one that I make a lot. I do something similar with rice. So again, the amount of time that it takes to cook rice is a bit more than pasta, but not much more if you skip the soaking. And I have this like a garlic butter and olive mix that I with a bit of chilies that I add, and then I kind of stir that into the rice with a bit of cheese, and I'm happy. And if you can make something yourself, it's so much more satisfying and it's more social. It's really a wonderful thing to do. But I also want to say one other thing. I don't want to be preachy, because I think any way you can get, you know, your food on the table is absolutely fine. So if people do get takeaways, those are really wonderful. There's so many available now more than ever. I think it's just that ultra processed food, the food that is just not food, is the one that I would try to avoid.
Fair enough too. Yotam, thank you so much for joining me on the Radio National Hour.
It was a pleasure, Michael.
And you can see Yotam Ottolenghi live in February next year as he tours Australia. Tickets are on sale now. And that's it from me for today and this week. A big thanks to the team behind the scenes, producers Claire O'Halloran, Linda Lopresti, Tyler Hall, and our executive producer, Katie Heyman. To see us into the weekend, let's listen to Dave Graney and the Coral Snakes singing Apollo 69 from my chat with them a couple of weeks back. Have a great weekend. Catch you Monday. Yes.
Apollo 69, rockets sulking in the desert heat, blowing off steam, spilling its seed on the barren dunes. Billowing pubic cloud below, groaning, shaking, scaffold sways, Nelson's column, Isaac Hayes, shaft watchtowers, yeah, Houston. What is happening, I reckon? What? I am not reading you. Yeah. Pioneers and diggers, psychedelic visitors, dune buggies appear like ponies on the cliff, like a wagon train to the stars. Coyotes wail, this coffee stinks. Hey, let's roll on to Mars. Yeah, yeah, Houston. Where's this sea of tranquility? Yeah, I am not reading you. Yeah, yeah. Oh, ow. sure those Reds are up to something. You know they got Rasputin's brain wired up to one of their missiles. Yeah, it's a black one, kind of like the pack leader. Castro, man, he's hot for the main feature, dying to shove his cigar into the yellow sugar cane. Apollo 69, rockets sulking in the desert heat, blowing off steam, spilling its seed on the barren dunes. Billowing pubic cloud below, groaning, shaking, scaffold sways, dying to fall onto another world, ride the wild Milky Way.
Listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.